The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Catherine Watterson, also known as Kitsy Burkhart, when I wrote for the Philadelphia Evening Bulletin a number of years ago. And tonight, I'm so honored to introduce Betty Metzger, the author of The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI, as well as three of the eight members of the courageous anti-war activist group who risked their futures to break into the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania 43 years ago and steal not just some, but every document in that office. During the following week after the burglary, while the FBI was looking frantically for the perpetrators, they moved 200 agents into the Powelton neighborhood, where I think many people from this audience live still. The group, which called itself the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI, photocopied and mailed out hundreds of the FBI's directives that proved beyond any doubt that the FBI had been waging an illegal and secret and criminal war on against political dissent, against civil rights and equal rights activism and justice. The Citizens Commission sent the first batch of files to five people, three journalists and two members of Congress. It shows how powerful J. Edgar Hoover's hold was, because four of those five who received the files gave them, turned them over to the FBI. But one person did not, and that was Betty Metzger, who was a reporter at the Washington Post at that time. She wrote the first story about the content of those documents. And after the Washington Post had published it, which was a struggle for them, because this was not popular thinking. People didn't believe it unless it had happened to them. But after her story, others picked up the story, and it opened the floodgates of investigations that would unmask Hoover and the FBI and ultimately open the public's mind to the Pentagon Papers that followed, Watergate, and other activities of our government that were illegal. For years, we've never known the identity of these burglars. But now, through Betty Metzger's brilliant book, we not only get to go inside the burglary itself, but inside the lives and the minds of the people who were committed. And she also takes us inside those times, which were so passionate. And with the escalation of the war and the bombings, she really shows what compelled these activists to take these risks to right the wrongs that they were seeing. Betty was a perfect person to do this book, and she's been working on it for 20 years. She not only worked as a journalist for the Washington Post and the Philadelphia Evening Bulletin, but she also became chair of the journalism department at San Francisco State University, and she is the founder of its Center for Integration and Improvement of Journalism. Her research in this book is exhaustive, and the story is so compelling, it's hard to imagine how many documents she read, how many interviews she conducted over two decades to create this book. Just alone, she read the 33,698 pages the FBI had put out about the media burglary, among other things. On stage with her tonight will be three of the eight members of the Citizens who were led by their hearts and their heads to take these risks for all of us. To me, they've always been heroes because they proved what we were experiencing but had not had any evidence of before except our own eyes, and that was not necessarily believed. The three are Johnny and Bonnie Raines, who had three young children at the time of the burglary, and Keith Forsyth. Keith is now an engineer, and at that time he was a full-time activist and a cab driver who went to locksmith school to learn how to pick the FBI's locks. John Raines, a professor of religion at Temple University, had been a freedom rider in the 1960s, where he witnessed the war against blacks in America. Bonnie Raines, who had taught in Harlem and had been educated by her experiences there, was director of a daycare center at the time of the burglaries. A missing person tonight is Harvard physics professor Bill Davidon, who was the architect. Haverford. What did I just say? Harvard. He died this past November, and so sadly he's not here with us. But as Betty writes, Bill wanted the public to know that despite the vast governmental power, the giant Goliath was vulnerable to small Davids, especially when the Davids joined together. Please join me in welcoming these Davids, Betty Metzger, John Raines, Bonnie Raines, and Keith Forsyth.
Good evening. It's wonderful to be here near the home of the burglary, in the home of the investigation that was done by 200 FBI agents trying to find these people. In case you haven't seen them recently, you've just now heard their names. This is Keith Forsyth, Bonnie Raines, and John Raines. It's especially nice to be in this immediate area, the beautiful library, and also this neighborhood. This is the neighborhood that Bill Davidon and his late wife, Maxine Libros, lived in immediately prior, in the years prior to her death in 2010, and enjoyed many things about this neighborhood, including coming here for events. So that feels like a special tie for us. I assume that if you're here and you have the enthusiasm that you've already shown, that you know a lot about the burglary. So I won't rehash the details except for some things that I'd like to say. It really began in 1970 when Bill Davidon had a very powerful idea. As he moved from peace organization to peace organization that year, people kept telling him that they thought that there were spies in their midst. And he was not a believer in conspiracies, and he was not someone who speculated. As a physicist, he believed in the scientific method, and he really thought that people were perhaps imagining that people in the movement by that time had such a sense of lack of hope or depression, really, about what they felt was their failure to stop the war. And so he thought, as he heard this more and more, and from a greater variety of people, he decided, I think this is true. And if it's true, if the government is officially suppressing dissent, this is a crime against democracy, and it's a crime that needs to be stopped. And in that idea was the origin of the question that he then asked 10 people he met with individually in late 1970 and asked, what do you think of burglarizing an FBI office? Now, not a question. Not a question that many people would be asked. He invited 10 people. One said no. One turned him down. And there were 9. And then, just not long before, just several days before the burglary, the 9th person abandoned the group. That person knew everything that was planned. And these people and the other burglars didn't seem to be fazed by that, or a number of other obstacles that I think most people would be fazed by. And they proceeded to plan, and they seemed to have, they did have, the same resolve that Bill had, which is hard for many of us to imagine, that instead of thinking like most people would about such a problem, how do you get evidence that the most powerful law enforcement agency in the country is suppressing dissent when it's also the most secretive and the most protected organization in the company? Most people, I think, would be safe to say, would have thought, this is a problem that cannot be solved. Sure, it's terrible, and simply lament. And Bill was a problem solver, and he thought, this problem is not too big to solve. It's so big, it must be solved. And that, in that commitment, and the commitment that the others joined with him, the burglary was born. The first news about the burglary was about 2 paragraphs long. It was a confirmation that the burglary had occurred. And somebody at the FBI said something about as profound as, a few things missing. And 2 weeks later, we found out everything was missing, that in the dark, the burglars had gone in, and they had removed every piece of paper they found. It amounted to about 1,000 files. The documents shocked the American public. Again, it's so important to remember what a revered person Hoover was. And there was that file that said, enhance the paranoia. Make people think there's an FBI agent behind every mailbox. That was a devastating thing to discover about the top law enforcement agency in the country. People started calling major members of Congress for the first time, prominent members of Congress, called for an investigation of the FBI. Major newspapers in their editorials called for investigation of the FBI, including the Philadelphia Inquirer, which prior to that time I don't think had ever written anything but praise for J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. And that's not to single out the Inquirer. That was true across the country. Fortunately, when I accidentally found the burglars, 2 of the burglars, thanks to John blurting out a secret in 1989, we think it was, fortunately, they have agreed to come forward and tell their stories. They first came forward on the day that the burglary was published and at a private showing of a documentary, 1971, that's also about their story and that will be shown here for the first time on May 28th at the Constitution Center. That seems like a very appropriate thing at the Constitution Center. And now, thanks to their deciding that they would no longer be silent, they and the significance of what they did, I hope, can be remembered. I'm going to start with a question that I think a lot of people ask. It was just asked of me this afternoon by a reporter who was trying to figure out how in the world you were able to do what you did. What made it possible for you to decide to do such a radical thing? Were there roots in your early lives? Was it in your evolution at that time? Keith, how would you decide how it was possible?
I think that's probably harder for the younger people to understand than the people who are our age and who lived through that era. But there were an awful lot of things very wrong with our country at that time. And not that it's perfect today, but it's not like it was then. So I don't know. It didn't seem like such a momentous decision at the moment. It was when you see something that's that's that wrong, and no one whose job it is to do something about it is doing anything about it, then it just seems then let's do it. I don't know how else to explain it.
Well, what about the evolution that you went through when you were at Worcester, though? You had been a very different person and then changed your position.
Oh, yeah. Well, sure, I come from the Midwest, from a small town. Not that I thought much about politics as a kid, but, you know, relatively conservative environment. So certainly in those days, I would never have, in my wildest dreams, imagined doing something like that. And I think what happened to me is what happened to a lot of people at, in my case, a fellow who's from Philadelphia, whom I haven't seen in the intervening 40-some years, gave me a small book about the history of Vietnam, about the war in Vietnam, that was published by the Quakers, the Religious Society of Friends. And at the time he gave me this book, I was uninterested in politics, and he was trying to convince me that I should be. And he gave me this book to read, and it really turned my whole life upside down, because this very short book detailed the history of American involvement in Vietnam and documented very well why there was absolutely no legitimate reason whatsoever for us to be there. It wasn't about democracy, it was about empire. And that all the things that I had been told by the media and by the society at large and by my schooling having to do with why we were over there were all lies. So it was quite a difficult thing to accept for me because I just wasn't used to the idea of thinking that people were lying to me. The Quakers were an organization I had a lot of respect for. I was, came from a very religious background. And there was a process involved, but basically when I came out the other end of the tunnel, I was convinced that they were right and what I had previously believed was completely wrong. And so at that point, I just felt like, I have to do something about this. I don't know if that answers your question.
Okay. Bonnie and John, would each of you describe your evolution coming to the point where you could do something like this?
Well, I guess I always, I was always, even as a child, concerned about the underdog, and particularly aware of how our society fails the poorest children. I taught school in East Harlem, and I became very aware of the inequality. And then I moved on from teaching school in New York to moving to Philadelphia and joining an enormous movement in protest against the war. There were many, many activists in Philadelphia at that time, and I was anxious to affiliate with those activists and look for ways to take action. We all did the same things. We marched, we went to rallies, we took buses to Washington. We did all of that to no avail, and the war was escalating, and the government was lying to citizens about the war. And I just became very, very much interested in the next step in protesting, and that became an affiliation with a group at that time, which was called the Catholic Left, and the group itself was called the East Coast Conspiracy to Save Lives. And with that group, we We went into draft boards in the middle of the night and removed draft files and destroyed them to try. We were one of many groups doing that kind of civil disobedience. We were doing what we could to disrupt the draft system, but the war continued to escalate. And therefore, it became a compelling thing for me to find another way as a citizen, as an individual concerned woman, to take action to begin to change systems in a serious kind of way. And that drew me into the part of the Catholic left that was interested in something like a break-in and Bill Davidson's ingenious idea, which is to break into an FBI office and remove files and hopefully have hard evidence about what was going on at that time.
I think it's so important to realize, as they talk about what they did, that they had no idea whether there was anything of value in the office, whether they'd find any document that would have the evidence that they had in mind. And I was thinking of that in contrast to Edward Snowden right now, who knew exactly what he was doing because he was an insider. They were an outsider. He saw the evidence and started collecting it. They went in and faced the same risk that if they had found empty forms, they would have faced the same risk as they faced when they found something significant. John, you've talked in the past about the evolution in your life and what made it possible.
Well, I'm looking at people with a lot of gray hair out there. I mean, some younger people. I suspect I'm looking at people who were back in the 1960s. Some of you were in the streets along with me, because that's what was going on back then. Philadelphia was a center of the protest movement in many respects. There were thousands and thousands of people out in the streets protesting against that war from 1965 right on through. I think the reason I got active with the East Coast conspiracy to save lives, learned my burglary skills, I must say, from priests and nuns, wonderful experiences. This is true.
Yeah. How many are here?
I got active in the civil rights movement beginning in 1961. I was a freedom writer and was arrested and put in jail in Little Rock. And that began for me a second education that in many respects I was not supposed to get. I was born into a relatively affluent family in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and went to private schools and private camps and elite schools and had all the lessons, tennis, sailing, horseback riding, all that stuff. I needed an education that I didn't get. The education I got first, and I didn't choose it, none of us gets to choose our first education or our first identity, was a life lived from top down, a world understood from top down, a world understood, an identity formed and shaped by being inside privilege and inside power. So I didn't know what it was like to live in America. I only knew what it was like to live in a little tiny bubble at the top. Well, I got a second education, and my teachers were the black folks down south. Many of them without college education, many of them couldn't write. They taught me what it meant to be an American. It's from them that I learned the price you are willing to pay for freedom. I saw people lose their jobs because they stood in a line, and I was standing behind a black woman in southwest Georgia in 1965. A woman half her age came up and said, "Bessie, you get out of that line or you never come to my house and work again." Bessie stayed in the line. That changed my understanding of what the meaning of a vote is. Now, it's easy to be cynicism, to be cynical today about votes, all the money that's pouring in and all that kind of stuff. But my God, those teachers, black folks, poor folks, taught me what it's like when you have to struggle for freedom, when you have to struggle for dignity. And that changed me. I went down south to help them. I came back from the south because I was there in 1964 in Mississippi. I was there at Selma in 65. I came back from the south with a different way of being John Raines. And that's what I brought to the war in Vietnam. that, and I knew damn well what J. Edgar Hoover was, because we found out what J. Edgar Hoover was down there in the South. J. Edgar Hoover hated Martin Luther King. J. Edgar Hoover hated the civil rights movement. He wanted things to return to quiet, his kind of life. He was not a good man. He has been the largest subversive in American history, fighting, as he said, subversion and subverting the freedoms of this country. And he very nearly got away with it. He was the most powerful man in Washington. Without any question, they could not touch him. So somebody had to do something about that man. And that became our task.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he did get away with it for half a century. And there are many people who think at that time and still that the FBI in the 1970s would have never been investigated. None of the questions would have been raised, or the change occurred if it had not been for what the burglary did. Despite all of the courage that you had and the willingness to go ahead, I know there also was a great deal of various kinds of fear. And I wonder if you could talk about some of your experiences. First, a very practical one for Keith. The night of the burglary. I think there were a couple times when you had unexpected experiences. First of all, you had trained to be able to break in how fast?
On average, 30 seconds.
He did the lockpicker Olympics every night in their attic, which was the center of the planning.
Right. And I just want to correct one slight misstatement that was made before. I didn't study lockpicking to break into the FBI office. I studied lockpicking to break into draft boards first. So,
but you got your expertise.
But the FBI was kind of like the graduate school.
So when you came that night in your top coat that you got at a thrift
right.
shop.
So we were all dressed very well, and most of the people in the group did not need haircuts to look respectable, but there were two of us that did, and so we got those haircuts. So we were willing to sacrifice a lot. In addition to Bonnie's casing of the inside, I had checked out the locks from the outside some time before to make sure that everything was good. And when I got there that night, one of the locks was different than the way I remembered it being, dramatically different, as in I don't know how to open that kind of lock.
Well, wasn't there also one more lock than you thought there was?
Well, this is where, you know, memory is a little vague after all these years, but I think there were always two locks on the door, but they were both the standard kind, like on your front door, which is cake to pick, not a problem.
For you.
Don't y'all feel good now?
In your house?
So, don't worry, I'm not short of money right at the moment. But the one of the locks, when I arrived that night, was not that type. It was a high security type lock, like you see today on a kryptonite bike lock, and that takes a special tool to pick and some special technique. So anyway, at that moment, my heart just sank, because immediately I thought, I'm incompetent because I didn't see this lock before, and B, the whole thing is off because I can't get through the door. Subsequent to after reading some of the documents you turned up, I think they had recently changed that lock, and that's why I didn't see it before. But be that as it may, at that point I completely lost my cool. I mean, I was not able to stay calm and think of a plan B. I just completely freaked out and called back to headquarters and said
a motel.
Yeah. I don't know what I said, but it probably wasn't that coherent. I was very upset. So that time, I did not get myself out of the fear. Well, it wasn't really fear. It was more just when you really want something very badly and very suddenly you think that you're not going to get it, you know, you're very upset. So, but they, everybody talked me down and said, let's think about this. And, of course, Bill was the king of calm. I know there's some quite a few people actually in the audience who knew Bill, and he just did not get flustered, and he was so analytical. And we all talked about it and said, well, what about the second door? So then I started to feel better. So I went back in.
But there was a problem with that second door.
Right. But not in the beginning. In the beginning, it was just a regular pin tumbler lock. I got through it no problem. I pushed the door, and it only went about a quarter of an inch. So there was a deadbolt on the other side. So I could hear the radio of the building manager underneath my feet. He lived right underneath where I was working. So I'm wondering, I wonder how loud it's going to be when I break this thing open with a crowbar. And is he going to hear me? So I did. I tried to make it as quick as possible on the theory that one loud noise is less upsetting than lots of small noises. And apparently my theory was right because I waited and nothing happened. And then I pushed the door a little further, and somewhere in the process, I think what you're probably referring to when you ask about fear is somewhere in this process of getting through the second door, I heard a clanking sound inside the office. At that point, I was scared. and I didn't know if it was the heating system or the FBI jostling furniture. You know, what are you going to do? You know, you take a couple deep breaths and hope it's the heating system. You know, it's just not the kind of thing you know, you're not going to give up at that point. I just can't imagine that.
We should also describe that this is happening in a very public place, really.
Right, right.
That the building in media.
Right, the hallway of an apartment building, actually.
Right. A stairwell, an open stairwell, well lit. You went in from the outside into a well lit space where you could be seen outside or inside. Went up the stairs. Everything was open to the third and fourth floors where people lived. And so the reason that he had been especially careful about trying to do it very fast was that they were concerned that residents might come by and there would be somebody standing breaking into an FBI office.
Right.
And what was planned to take about 30 seconds ended up taking quite a long time.
It took much longer. I don't know how lengthy we want to get here, but basically after I got through the deadbolt, I got another half inch and the door stopped again. And there was a ginormous file cabinet. Yeah, well, you probably did.
But he had no choice.
But you forgot to move it while you were in there. So I started, you know, I could tell by the way the door moved that it was the doorknob was hitting the file cabinet. So I started pushing, and this thing started tipping. And I'm guessing it weighed roughly 100 pounds, something of that order, about what I weighed. So if it had hit the ground, that would have been the end, because I know that would have awakened everybody in the building. So there had to be a way to move it. And the floor was carpet. So I eventually went out to the car. Thank goodness this was 1971 and not 20 years later when they had real jacks in cars, and got the pillar out of a jack about so long and used that as a pry bar. So there I was laying on the floor of the hallway.
Where a resident could have come by at any time.
With my feet braced up against the wall working this pry bar, jack stand about a millimeter at a time. I don't really remember how long it took me. It seemed like 100 years, but it was probably at least 20 minutes. because you couldn't move it very far without tipping it over. And that was really the most nerve-wracking, because it would be pretty hard to explain that, that scene. That was a relief when that was over and I finally got inside.
Okay, let's talk about a different kind of fear. John, the kind of fear that you experienced in the weeks leading up, the fear and concern about the family. There were four of the burglars who had children, but John and Bonnie had three small children at the time.
And we were both burglars, therefore we both faced possible prison time. Bonnie was much more courageous in some ways than I was. After Bonnie went into the FBI and cased them and found out there was no security devices either on the file cabinets or on the doorways, then it became clear, and it was the first time it did become clear, that we were going to do this. And that's when I started getting nervous, because I knew that J. Edgar Hoover would throw everything he had at us. And he did. I mean, he sent out 200 agents to try to find us. They were everywhere. I mean, some of you, if you were living in Powhatan Village or the University City back then, you remember how many of their FBI, they just poured all over the place. And, for the first 5 years, I was scared. We were very lucky in the sense that we had done our casing very carefully. We were not reckless. We were meticulous. And then we were also very lucky because there were thousands of activists back then. And when they left no physical evidence, you know, from the scene itself of the burglary, we could
gloves
disappear.
Gloves at all times.
Well, they'll want you. Then we could disappear into this sea of fellow activists. And with very little physical evidence to go on to separate us out from the other thousand activists, it became really impossible, retrospectively, it became impossible for those 200 agents to find us. But for the first 5 years, I was looking over my shoulder every now and then.
Oh. And Bonnie, would you talk about the philosophy that you and John had really developed long before the burglary about resistance and family?
I think we came to the realization that it really is up to every citizen in a democracy to protect rights in a democracy. And if there is abuse of those rights, you can't just sit back and wait for someone else to either take action or look the other way. So we felt determined to participate as citizens. And also, a second very important reason for us was that we were thinking about the kind of society our children would grow up into, and what was that society going to look like in terms of a true democracy. And we wanted to try to guarantee the rights of all citizens as much as we could individually. And we felt that you don't stop being responsible because you are parents. In some ways, you need to be more responsible because you're really investing in your children's future. So we were a political family. Our children were hearing a lot about activism and the war in Vietnam, and they were beginning to understand the values that were so important to us and to our colleagues.
Well, you have to remember that we still routinely as a society require fathers and mothers to take on jobs that protect and help the rest of us, that put them in jeopardy. Every day a policeman goes to work, he or she puts their kids' lives on the line. Every day fire people go out and climb the ladders, they put their families in jeopardy. Every day, mothers and fathers in the armed services go out overseas and fight. They put their families in jeopardy. We don't ever stop, you know, being citizens. Probably the single most important gift we give to our children is not their education, although that's important. It is the nation they're going to live their adult lives in and raise their children and grandchildren in. That's the most important gift we give our kids. If we did not stop J. Edgar Hoover, there was nobody in Washington who were going to stop that man. We had to do what we did, or it just wouldn't get done.
Keith, you were going to.
I was just going to say what John just said, you know, quote John. Because I think that's a tremendous analogy.
Do you remember, as one of the youngest members of the group at the time, do you remember?
Still am.
Sorry about that. But you're a father now. And you don't have the white hair. Do you remember what you thought when you saw those three kids running around the house as you were planning the burglary? Did that mean anything?
Oh, absolutely. I thought, these people are some people with guts. Meaning these two right here.
I'd just like to ask one more. Go ahead.
I was very impressed.
I'd like to ask one more question of you before we turn it over to audience questions. In looking back and thinking of the burglary and its aftermath and today, what do you think is the most important discovery or lesson that emerged from the burglary and its impact? Keith?
Boy, that's a tough one.
You can succeed.
Yeah, yeah.
You can beat them.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Goliath is tough, but he's not invulnerable. And so I think that's still true today and probably always will be.
Bonnie.
I think probably it has something to do with truth. That if you can get the truth out there and articulate the message that needs to go out, that people will take that seriously and in some cases change their expectations of their government. That's one of the things I think I learned. The other is how frightening it is that one man in one institution can gather so much raw power to do what he did over five decades. And that is frightening to me and hopefully will not ever happen again. But that was certainly, that lesson was there.
Right. Bill Davidson was very strong on these points also and talked about the importance of planting seeds of hope, being willing to fail, but trying over and over again, and say how many times that the movement did fail, but this one time we did succeed, and how good it felt. Right. We'd like to have questions from the audience. Okay. Oh, there's a mic coming, right?
I spent a lot of...
Would you like to please identify yourself?
My name's Rick Conrad. I spent a lot of years working with Bill Davidson, and there was a night on April 4th, 1968, where we were at a meeting planning a demonstration that was going to happen April 6th. And we had been told by John Mark Blowen, the coordinator of Committee for Nonviolent Action, there was a chance that Martin Luther King would come to the demonstration if the city... basically gave a schedule. He was actually scheduled to start the Poor People's Campaign, which all of us intended to be part of. And the phone rang in the office, and this is a story about Bill Davidson, really, because he was really, I think, our leader. I mean, there were many others, like George Lakey, but Bill, for me at least, was the great inspiration. And the phone rang, and John Mark went to answer it. And I think all of us were wondering, was that from Martin Luther King that he was going to come to our demonstration? It was the battleship New Jersey being christened to go and slaughter people in Vietnam. So John Mark couldn't talk, and his wife Jill went over, and Bill said, was it King? And John was just, his tears were just flowing all over, and Jill said King had been killed. And I wondered how much, you know, maybe in retrospect, if that, because I my understanding is there's a document where Hoover says we're going to have to use the drug strategy to destroy the civil rights movement, but he certainly, you know, was in print shown to be a total enemy of civil rights.
Yes.
No, the question. I wanted to share that. Is that where that document came from? The one about where King was talking about the exploiting drugs? That was from your break-in, right?
That was the most explosive document. We didn't know what COINTELPRO meant, a counterintelligence program. It's written on the top of one of the documents, but we didn't know what that was. And it took about 2 or 3 years and a very important investigative reporter that worked for the NBC, Carl Stern. And then he had to use the Freedom of Information Act. Finally, following the trail of COINTELPRO, he got the documents. And one of those documents, and Betty has seen it actually, one of those documents was in fact the letter that was sent anonymously to Dr. Martin Luther King in 1964, blackmailing him and saying the only way he can get out of this, clear his name now, is to commit suicide. That was okayed by J. Edgar Hoover, and that was sent to Martin Luther King.
The COINTEL was revealed as a result of a document in the media, burglary, that just simply had that label on the top. And that was the cue that Carl Stern took up. But the files about Dr. King weren't there. But there were files in the media group that documented the blanket surveillance of the African-American community, not only in Philadelphia, but throughout the United States. Right. Yes. Back there, please.
Good evening, and thanks for attending this. Were the documents you recovered from the FBI office limited to FBI files, or were there also CIA files included?
Were there any CIA files?
No. The files that we obtained were in just two categories. One, about 40% of them were related to criminal investigations, and we didn't want to do anything with those because we didn't want to jeopardize witnesses, for example. About 60% of the documents were political in nature, and that's what we concentrated on, and that's where we found some very incriminating pieces of information. There was nothing related to national security whatsoever.
Yes.
How did you form your group? Did you stay in touch with people afterwards? And who did you send the documents to besides Betty?
You want me to take it? So, starting with the last question, we sent out the documents in sort of in waves. The initial set went to Betty, to Scoop Nelson, at the Washington Bureau of the LA Times, to Tom Wicker, to Representative Perrin Mitchell, and to Senator George McGovern. Senator McGovern and Representative Mitchell sent them back to the FBI. Mitchell at least said that there was disturbing material in it, which was further than McGovern went. The ones that went to Tom Wicker went back to the FBI also. I don't think anyone knows for sure how that happened, whether he got them and returned them or whether they were intercepted and returned. No one knows. The ones that went to Scoop Nelson, he went to his deathbed never knowing that he'd been sent the files because the mailroom person there was an FBI informer and was reading all of his mail and grabbed the documents and sent them back to the FBI before he got them. So luckily, Betty was not high enough on the enemies list to have her own private informer, and so the documents got through to her. Then later on, they were sent to other people as well. As far as how we got together, I think Betty described it accurately. Bill decided who he thought was trustworthy, and he approached us one at a time. And that was how the group was organized. And basically, I think I think we all felt, I know I felt, if, you know, if someone was, if Bill thought they were trustworthy, then that was all I needed to know, they were trustworthy. We agreed not to get together again after we finished distributing the last of the documents for security reasons, which is also why we didn't keep everything that we found. We trashed a lot of it because it was basically evidence. So we culled the most important things and distributed it and characterized, you know, counted up what we had. But we didn't keep it, and we didn't stay in touch with each other. So we intentionally basically avoided each other for the next,
5 years.
Yeah, longer than 5 years,
well,
really.
Yes.
Yeah,
longer. Yeah. I'd just like to add to what it's about Jack Nelson. At that time, by 1971, there were probably only two reporters in the country who were had written anything that raised questions about J. Edgar Hoover or the FBI. And the most, the strongest one of those was Jack Nelson. And what's been discovered later, since then, is that at that time, Hoover had a very active campaign going inside the LA Times to get Jack Nelson fired. He failed at that, but he succeeded in some ways, for instance, by there being somebody inside the office who looked at his mail and in this instance made sure that he never got the mail.
Two questions. Betty, how long was it between the time that you received the files and your first story?
I received the files at 10 o'clock in the morning, and by 10 o'clock that night, Catherine Graham had decided to publish, and they were in the next day's paper. That was not a simple thing, though. I mean, she did not want to publish. It was the first time that a journalist had ever received secret government files from someone outside the government who had stolen them, in contrast to an inside whistleblower. And so that raised ethical, legal questions, and the inside counsel also opposed publication. But two editors, Ben Bradley and Ben Bagdikian, strongly pushed for publication, and she changed her mind. And this was also the first time that the Nixon administration had pressed her to not publish a story, to suppress a story. She had much practice with that later on, as you know.
And the second question is for the group. 1,000 files. Are there any files still out there, or how did you destroy them?
Well, with the criminal files, we just burned them. We destroyed them. The political files, we sent all of them off that we had.
We photocopied them first, and sent.
Oh yeah, and that was interesting too. Bill took half of the files to a copying machine, a Xerox machine at Haverford, and I took the other half. How many people are from Temple? Oh, dear.
Copy machines at Temple.
On the weekend when the office was closed, but I had a key to get in, of course, I took half of the files to the Xerox machine in the religion department of Temple University. We didn't realize that every Xerox machine has a fingerprint. On the drum, you can trace back a given document, copied, to a particular machine. We didn't know that at the time. About 2 weeks after we mailed the documents into the story broke, I was in my office one day, and I saw a Xerox car pull up the curb. Guy get out, came into our Xerox machine, removed the drum, and left. Now, the great mystery is, who was that guy?
Well, we know he was from Xerox.
The files that I copied could have been traced right to that office, but it never happened.
It was interdisciplinary. The physics department at Haverford also, their Xerox machine did heavy duty.
So I'm sure that you see echoes of yourselves in Edward Snowden, although what he did was slightly different. But we've seen a lot of outrage over the information that he's made public and not a lot of action. In your opinions, what do we do next?
Well, make demands of citizens. I mean, we knew something about the FBI and the degree of surveillance that they were using to intimidate, not to investigate, but to intimidate. It was a political action. NASA and CIA want us to be afraid. They need for us to be afraid. In some strange way, NASA and the CIA run on the same gasoline as the terrorists. The terrorists want us to be afraid to go into public space that we share in common, space that we share in common that we must take for granted as safe. We can't get on the bus in the morning and truly think this guy might be a terrorist. We take it for granted, have to take it for granted. That's what the terrorists want to take away from us. CIA, NSA, same gasoline. They want us to be afraid. They need us to be afraid. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs depending upon us continuing to be afraid, really thinking we have to have thousands and hundreds of thousands of people out there protecting us. We give each other the gift of safety every time we walk out of the door in the morning. We are the ones who provide a safe environment for all the rest. I'm not downplaying terrorism. I'm just saying there's some kind of strange ideology, that gasoline of fear. Fear. You got to be afraid. Look out, look out, look out. You need us. You need us. Don't ask us questions. Don't ask us questions. Don't know we can't answer those questions. It's all national security. Be afraid. Be afraid. Well, look out. Some of us won't be afraid.
I just want to say something. It's not really directly related to your question, but is related to Edward Snowden. I think that, you know, there's been most of the people who've commented in one way or the other about what we did and about our recent coming out it's been favorable. You know, editorials in the paper and individual comments on the internet and so on and so forth. If this had been 30 or 40 years ago, I bet the proportion of favorable comments would have been an awful lot less. The reality wouldn't have been any different, but the opinion would have been. And I think we're seeing a little bit of that with Edward Snowden. You know, there was a hilarious bit on The Daily Show about him getting pardoned by some president 300 years from now. And, you know, it's funny because it's sad and because it's true that it's you know, I'm grateful that people are, you know, in favor of revealing government illegitimate secrets by whatever means necessary. But I think, you know, in some ways it's more pertinent to ask what can we do about what's happening today. I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think, you know, we have to figure out and do something.
I can answer that question. We talked about it quite a bit. He had no file on the FBI, but what he had was a strong perception that turned out to be true. He thought that J. Edgar Hoover was a consummate bureaucrat and as such would keep greatly detailed files on everything, including documents about how to deal with dissent. He really didn't have any idea the dirty tricks that would be involved with dealing with such things, but he thought that J. Edgar Hoover would require that meticulous records be kept of everything. He also assumed he was a right-wing ideologue, and that when you combine those two things, that was a very dangerous combination. He had no idea what files would be found, just that it was probably true that very dangerous, explicit files might exist. Yes?
Why the media office? There was other FBI offices locally, so one question is why media? My second question is, over the 5 years, did the FBI ever get close to any of the eight?
The answer to why media was Because you couldn't do the downtown Philadelphia, and it was a great big building. It was used 24 hours a day.
We did case the Philadelphia FBI office, but it was the security was too tight.
Yeah, but why would – well, for instance, back then they had, it was in Lansdale. They had an office in Lansdale, aside from media. Why did you pick media over the other outlying Philadelphia?
It was closer to Bill's home.
Yeah.
Divine guidance.
Yeah, I don't really know.
When he tells the story, he describes going downtown one day for another purpose. I thought, I'll check out where the FBI is. A tall building, impossible, 24-hour security. And then he describes, sometime later, looking in his suburban phone book. He lived in Haverford on the campus, looking in his suburban phone book. Oh, an FBI office in media. Went out and looked, and then some others went later and decided, this might be doable. Yeah. Yes, back here.
I'm Patience Reyes. I want to ask, do you think this would ever be a movie?
Well, there's a documentary that you'll have a chance to see in the late May, as I announced, on May 28th at the Constitution Center. And there are some people who have expressed interest in making a movie. But you have a chance to see the real. Yes, sir.
So first of all, you have to excuse me, I've got a bit of a cold. Everything you've said has been very inspirational. I want to thank you for you know, your sacrifice. This is an ongoing struggle. Thank you. Yes. This is an ongoing struggle. We have to continue to do this. And I'm looking around the room, and I'm really happy to see, you know, all you people here. But what I'm not happy is about is that I don't see any young people here.
Mm. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
There's a few.
Great. Bring your friends, okay?
Some of my students back there, I see them. Awesome.
Not that I'm not young, but that's besides the point. Two questions. Do you have any plans? And if not, will you help us if we organize plans to come speak to young people at their schools and wherever they hang out?
Young people haven't lost heart, and young people haven't lost hope. I teach that age group at Temple University, and I think there's a great yearning to begin to try to believe in the meaning of America again. And the meaning of America is freedom and fairness. And we've lost a lot of that. But the heart has not been lost in those young folks. They got a lot of heart. And I think they're waiting for the right moment. And that moment surely will happen, because our country is in very bad shape right now. I mean, the inequality, the massive inequality, the massive use of money that just takes the vote away from the rest of us. Just all money now. Not only in elections, but between elections, all that carpet-bagging stuff that goes on down in Washington. Well, the young people haven't given up on this country. That's my experience.
I also think we have to, as more mature citizens now, help the young people connect, help them find ways to connect, to organize using their social media and every other good tool that they have, so that they're not just feeling cynical and apathetic and alone in looking at the problems in our country, that they can be empowered by connecting, and we can help them try to make that possible.
Yeah, I think to the extent that, you know, we are able to do speaking things, we're probably more interested in talking to young people than to other geezers like us.
We've had some nice invitations from schools and universities. So.
We have time for one more question.
This is a logistical question for Bonnie. I'm just picturing that sketch of you. I want to hear about it. I haven't read the book yet. I will. It's probably answered in the book. But who drew that? Why did they draw it? Did they draw sketches of everyone who came in? Like, how did that sketch get made? Oh.
Well, I don't know if in the introduction, I was back here where I couldn't hear everything that was being said, but Betty describes it in the book that my role in preparing for the burglary was to go inside the office. Therefore, my face was, after the fact, they realized that they'd been cased by my face. I did try to disguise my appearance as much as I could. I never took my gloves off the whole time I was taking notes in my little notebook when I was interviewing the men in the office. But it was a pretty crummy sketch, and it didn't really it didn't look very much like I looked on a day-to-day basis. They did realize it.
They thought of her immediately, that there was that woman, as J. Edgar Hoover would often refer to, that woman who came into the office.
Right. And they find me that woman. I mean, yeah, it's a quote.
J. Edgar, she's right here.
But there were so many young women who were activists at that time. I could have been just any one of 529-year-old women in Philadelphia at that time.
And some of those people suffered a lot of abuse at the hands of the FBI because they thought that they were Bonnie.
Very frightening.
Having your door broken down and that sort of thing.
I'd like to thank you very much. And I would also just like to say that, given everything that we now know about the impact of what they did, we have here people who have pulled off one of the most powerful nonviolent acts of resistance in the country, like this president. No matter what the New York Times.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.